Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, July 1st, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, available via podcast on iTunes and the Stitcher app, as well as on the blog on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with John Mutter, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the popular publishing industry website Shelf Awareness. But first up, author Dan Pope. Dan is the author of In the Cherry Tree. His short stories have appeared in many journals, including Crazy Horse, Harvard Review, Iowa Review, McSweeney's, Shenandoah, Gettysburg Review, and others. He's a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where he attended on a Truman Capote Fellowship. He is a winner of the Glenn Schaefer Award from the International Institute of Modern Letters, and Grants in Fiction from the Connecticut Commission of the Arts. His new book is Housebreaking, published by Simon & Schuster. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, really glad you could join us. Let's start by having you introduce the book for us. Could you tell us about Housebreaking?
Housebreaking, sure. It's a novel that has been described as one of suburban dysfunction. It revolves around two families who come together and interact during one long fall of 2006, I think it is.
I would like to know, when you began writing the novel, how you got into it. Did it start with a character or more the setting or the nature of the dysfunction or, you know, how did it?
How did it start? It started with this dog. You know, these ideas for writing come from somewhere, and the one for me came from this dog who arrived at my parents' house one day. I think I was home from school, and he'd gotten off his leash and he came over to my parents' house and he started barking, and our dog went out to play with him. This other dog had escaped on a long leash. And our dogs played. They romped around, and they finally got tired of each other. Well, my dog got tired of this other dog, and the other dog stayed out all night. Sort of, I think he fell a bit in love with our dog. And then his mom came by the next day to collect his dog, and off they went. And this happened again and again and again. And we got to know this dog and this other family that lived on the next street, and that was the beginning of the germ, of the novel that came to me as how these two families could meet and start to interact, involving this dog who brought them into each other's lives.
And I'd like to talk about point of view. So the story is told with multiple points of view, and the reader slips into and out of different characters' perspectives, and there's even some overlap in terms of the timeline. And one review I read online described the effect of this as giving the reader a panoramic view of the story, and that was my impression too. And the world and the characters were so fully realized, I really looked forward to returning to your book, honestly. And
thank you.
Well, I've seen your writing compared thematically to like Tom Perata and Richard Russo. And for me, I found the writing similar to Jonathan Franzen's, just for the lushness. And so could you talk, first of all, about your choices regarding point of view? Did you know from the beginning that there would be multiple points of view?
Well, first, thanks for the comparison to Franzen. I think Richard Russo and Tom Perata write about the same milieu as I do, you know, these people in the, you know, not urban families, but trying to get along, and I do think it's more like well, I shouldn't compare myself to Franzen, but you did, so I can talk about it. But I think Perata is satirical, and Richard Russo could be satirical, whereas Franzen I think gets a little darker and deeper, and that's the sort of the mood I was going for with my book. As for the point of view, I think that's your strongest posture as a writer is point of view, to get, you know, deeply inside the characters, and I think that's why we come to books, you know, not genre books or entertainment books. I think those you read for plot, but something, you know, a bit more. We like to get deeper into character, and I think point of view as you know, is your best technique to get into that. As the story, as the novel took shape, I always knew I'd you know, go into a few different point of views. And the dog I mentioned at the start, there is a dog in the book and on the front cover of the book. I was going to have a dog point of view as well, who would roam these streets at night and sort of come up with his impressions of the world. But that didn't turn out to be something I could do.
But you did try, I hope.
I did try it. I had this dog, you know, roaming and sniffing and smelling and seeing things. But as well as I know dogs, I couldn't quite get inside the dog mind to make it work. So instead, I settled for the characters that I did choose as the a point of view characters. One's an 84-year-old man. The two others are three others are sort of people in the prime of their lives and in their middle age. And then there's the young girl in the book who's 17, I think she is. And so in that way, we get an idea of the quite a wide perspective on the characters.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Dan Pope. His new novel is Housebreaking. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And just to follow up on that question about the temporal overlaps, I'm wondering if that posed challenges to you in terms of keeping the story fresh when you backtracked in someone else's shoes for a little bit, or can you talk about that part of the writing?
Oh, gosh, you hit that one on the head when you say, was it hard? You know, I didn't, talking about the point of view again, I thought I would just move the story straight ahead and skipped from one point of view to the next, so there would just be one telling of the story. And I think I did a first draft of this book in about a year. And then I realized it just wasn't working, and I couldn't quite figure out why. But then I thought, well, it's jumping around too much. We're going from one character, all these characters I just mentioned, the older man and the husband and wife and the other characters would jump around, and we wouldn't. I don't know. It didn't give the reader enough time to sort of stay in their perspective, and sink down into them and get to know who these characters are. So after scratching my head for a while, I thought, you know what? I'll stay in their character. I'll stay in their point of view character for these characters a bit longer, and how to do that. And then it turned out I had to sort of take the book apart and put it back, you know, through these long sections that each character now has, where it overlaps in the same time period. You see the same time period from four different perspectives by the time you reach the end of the book. So, yeah, that was hard. And as I did that, I had to get a calendar of that fall of that year and make sure that each occurrence that we see happened at the right time as we overlapped it. I don't know why that gave me so much trouble. Perhaps I don't know. Maybe I'm not good with dates. But that turned out to be a lot of work. I'm not sure if it would have been as much work if I conceived it that way from the start. But the way I did get around to it, it took a lot of checking and going back and checking again. In fact, right up to the end, the very proofs, I saw a little time glitch there, and we had to sort of delay the next round of proofs for 2 weeks while I finally got that fixed. So if anyone notices a time glitch, they feel free to write me. But I think I straightened it all out. So yes, that was a real head scratcher.
So would you read to us at this point, Dan, from Housebreaking?
Sure. Should I introduce the scene?
Yes, if it's not the beginning, please.
Not the beginning, no. So the older gentleman I mentioned, who's 84, his name is Leonard. He's had a stroke, and he gets he's in the hospital trying to recover about a couple days into it, and a friend comes to see him. So that's where we are now. Wakey, Len. Some time had passed. He could not say how long. He blinked, trying to focus. A face was peering down at him, not 3 inches away. A grotesque painted mouth. Who are you? He tried to say. Don't strain yourself, Len. You just take it easy. That's why they got you in this dark room, to reduce stimulation. You probably don't even know who I am. Your mind's all muddled right now. It's Terry. Do you remember? Think, Glenn. You got to start using your noggin again. He felt ashamed that he did not know the woman. I'm fine, he managed. I called the house looking for you, and your son told me what happened. You must feel terrible, you poor man. I went through the same thing with Dick Sr. He had a stroke in 99. He was a clotter, just like you. We were driving home from the China Palace, and he started swerving all over the road, and the leftover chicken teriyaki fell into my lap. I called him an idiot. Look what you did to my suede skirt. And then he stopped the car and put his forehead on the steering wheel and started foaming at the mouth. I got out of the car and lit a cigarette. I was in shock. There was a payphone there on the corner, and I dialed Dick Jr. Dickie, I said, your father just dropped dead. By the time the ambulance showed up, Dick Sr. was speaking in tongues. Ooga booga booga, he was saying. There was a smell of something clean in the room. His wife always used it in the kitchen. The word eluded him, but the scent still lingered in his lungs. He heard a rhythmic beeping and the sound of a loudspeaker in the distance. Was he at an airport? Was he going on a trip? Dick Sr. came home from the hospital as blind as a bat. For 2 months, all he did was dribble and drool. Then one day he said, I can see, Terry. He could hardly hold up his head. One minute he'd be sitting there, and the next minute he'd have his chin on his chest. The doctor wouldn't give him a cane. He said if he started with a cane, he'd be using it for the rest of his life. I tell you, the man had to learn how to walk again, how to use a fork, everything. He tried to comb his hair with a toothbrush. It would have been funny if it weren't so pathetic. And Dick Sr. was a proud man. They gave him exercise to work his mind, a stack of cards with pictures on them. Even a first grader could do it. I showed him a picture of a refrigerator and a picture of a car, and I asked, now, Dick, which one is the car? And he got it wrong. No, Dick, that's a refrigerator. So I asked him again, and he got it wrong again. One day he wanted to help with a dinner. I told him to boil the water. A minute later, he was on fire. He lit his sweater on the burner, and he didn't even know it. He couldn't feel a thing in his right arm. I realized something was wrong when I smelled the burning wool. You're on fire, Dick, I said, and I threw a glass of water at him. But each day, he got a little better. He'd go out for a walk and pull his right leg along like it was a piece of wood. Come on, leg, Dick would say. Keep up with me, you jerk. Then one morning, he woke up with tears streaming down his face, saying his leg hurt. Let me get the heating pad, I said. No, Terry, you don't understand. I can feel my leg. I can feel my leg. A few weeks later, he was back on the golf course. This probably doesn't mean anything to you now, Len. You probably don't even know your own name. And you wouldn't remember, and you won't remember any of this later. You're like a newborn baby there in your diaper. The important thing is not to worry. You just stay calm. Listen to old Terry. Everything's going to be fine. He felt a hand stroking his hair. Oh, look, Len. It's Oprah. Last week she had a show on sex addiction. One gal said she'd had relations with 25 men. Everyone oohed and aahed and clucked their tongues. I'm thinking, 25? Is that all? Oh, shush, Len. Stop that gibbering. Let's listen to Oprah. That's the end of that little scene.
Thank you. That was author Dan Pope reading from his new book, Housebreaking. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Now, as you illustrated with that reading, your characters are complicated. And so do you have a method to help you fully develop your characters? Do you do sketches or write letters from their perspective? Or what's your technique?
Gosh, you know, that's just the kind of thing that I tell my students when I teach writing. And I tell them right before you start, you know, make sure you put enough time to write those letters and sketches and write a little biography of their lives. And I did do that, and it turned out as I wrote the book, and it changed, as I told you earlier, with the structure, that the characters changed too, and almost all of my ideas, the characters got thrown out, except for their general ages and place in life. So, I learned with this book, writing it over three to 4 years off and on, that sort of the best way to get to know them is just to keep writing and see how they evolve and put them in these situations and see how they perform. So, yeah, I did do that. I tried to get them to know earlier, and I did all the other tricks that I do to get to know characters. You know, I base their appearances on friends, on people I know, and that things of that sort. But I found, at least for this book, that still it was in the writing that I got to know who they were.
And another part of the writing that you helped illustrate with that reading you did is the strength of the dialogue. So how has that always been something that's come easily, or Do you have any dialogue writing trips to share?
Dialogue writing tips. The first part of that question is I think that's the mode that I work best in. I've always had I've always liked to hear people speak. I'm always interested in how they speak. I like doing imitating the way others talk, and I think I find their speech that way. I wrote most of it. There's a couple of scenes in Starbucks in this book. Some important things take place in Starbucks, and that's because I think I wrote a good half the book by longhand in Starbucks. And you just overhearing the way people talk is one tip I would have. Just sit next to them and listen to how they go. Dialogue is it's not real speech. It's sort of some teacher called it once the greatest hits of speech. So you have to edit out all the oohs and ahs and ums and those things and the small talk and find sort of the interesting things that people are saying to each other.
And I read in an interview online about your first book and how your writing schedule worked for that. And if I recall, so it took around 3 months to write the first draft.
And yes.
But you talked earlier about writing this book for 3 to 4 years off and on. So could you talk a little more about your writing schedule for writing this book?
This one was much different. The first one, I did have a particular schedule. I wrote it from midnight to like 6 a.m. I remember when I heard the first chirp of a bird, I would stop and retreat, and that would be it for the night. And it, for that, the first draft took, on that crazy schedule, took about 3 months only. And then there's always the next maybe 8 months it took to revise the book and move things around and get the sentences just right. This one was a completely different experience. As I said, I wrote it mostly in Starbucks because that's the only shop we have here in my town where you can have a coffee, and with people talking and cell phones going off and music blaring. And for some reason, with this one, I was able to write it. Not at night, in the afternoon, by longhand. And then I, would come back home and type the thing into my computer. So just the experience was much different to write the book. That the sentences are, real sloppy, as you can imagine. With that, and trying to write in that sort of, it's hard to block out a lot of stuff. But at least it was written in public in the daytime, and then there was so that took about a year, actually almost exactly a year. But then there was the structural problem, which I mentioned earlier, where I had to restructure the book, and that did take a lot of sort of doing and undoing, almost to the point where you're like, oh, I should start a different book. So that it was almost like starting a whole new book. It took that process of revising it took maybe a whole another year or two, and then some tinkering, and then the process, of sending your agent, and he sends you some comments, and then back and forth, and then that starts again with my editor, and that took like another 6 months of revisions. So, yeah, it went through a lot of drafts.
Can you talk just a bit more about the revisions? It's interesting for those of us in the trenches with it to hear so about the timeline issue. Were there other major issues you can pinpoint that were, you went back and forth on?
Yeah, and I'm hoping some of my MFA students don't hear this, because I tell them to save time to get all this stuff done up front, to get your structure up front, to get your characters up front, to know who the perspectives are. But I thought I had that, but it just, all of that changed in this process of revision. So yeah, my structure changed. One of the characters, his name is Andrew. In the first draft, he was a sweet guy, really nice guy, doing his best to help his wife through this difficult situation. And as you can imagine, on the page at least, a guy like that is really boring. So I got him to the end of the book as a very sweet, nice guy, and it was just a disaster. So he had to be completely reversed. Andrew became just the opposite of that. He became something of a real jerk. But he's fun to watch. He's fun to read because he's sort of so cold he feels himself that he's higher than most other people. So yeah, there is a lot of things that happen in revision, but you know, that's I think that's where it does all happen. I think a lot of writers, or perhaps a lot of you know younger writers, think they can do that first draft and it's just about done. But I think it does take about 5, 6, 10 drafts to get it all right the way you want it to. I mean, if you can get it out the first draft perfectly, that's right, and that's great. And there's certainly some scenes I wrote in this book that, including the one I just read you, that I thought I nailed them the first time. But I think most of it happens in the process of revision, and most of the fun for me happens in the revision too. You know, you just add a sentence or add a line of dialogue, and the whole thing seems to just expand and get much better, and gives you the sort of the energy to continue with the book.
On a day-to-day basis, when you were writing at the Starbucks and then typing at night, did you do any revising at that point, going from the handwritten to the typing, or did you just create yourself, like, act as data entry at that point?
It got all mixed up. That was supposed to be my process. I read about a Latin American writer who goes out. Have you heard about this guy? It's I think his name is, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but I think it's Cesar Area, where he has this incredible process where he goes to the coffee shop every day. He brings one beautiful piece of paper, some highly bond paper, and his beautiful fountain pen. I hope I'm getting this right. This is just my version of it. And he goes to the same coffee shop, and he spends the day there, and he writes one perfect page. And by the end, the page itself is a piece of art, he says, with his beautiful handwriting and whatever drawings or doodles he might put in there. And he brings that back, and he puts that down, and that is done. That's the end of the process. And he will never go back and write that again. And he moves forward from there. So I would love to have a process like that where I don't go back, but that's just not me as a writer. In fact, I don't see how, perhaps he's the only one in the world who doesn't go back, because you sort of have to go back. But at the coffee shop, it all got mixed up. Longhand, then I'd print it out and bring a draft with me and mark that up, and then I got tired of putting in the revisions myself, so I paid one of my students to do it. So yeah, then 10 different drafts would come to me from some other different students who I engaged to type for me, because I found that process was really sort of difficult to me to you know, go over the thing all day and type in the changes you just hand wrote to the manuscript. So there wasn't any perhaps I'm not a well-organized person, but the Starbucks where I worked was very interesting. There was a crime there while I was working there one day.
Oh, wow, that I had a flash of The Girl on the Train, but...
I haven't read that yet.
Which I haven't read, but I mean, no, I mean, I'm thinking sequel or, you know, but so you, I mean, I want to hear more about the crime, but since we're running out of time, I'll look away. But so you received your MFA from Iowa. And
yes.
you've mentioned through the course of our conversation teaching. So where is it that you teach?
Right now, I teach at in Danbury at the WestCon MFA program.
Oh, okay. So you're a believer in MFAs, then?
You know, I can give you pros and cons, but just my experience alone was wonderful at Iowa. Frank Conroy was still the director there back in 2002. He died shortly thereafter, but. Yeah, but mainly it was such a wonderful experience to be around the other people in the program. They came from all areas of life. Most of them were young, but all ages, up from early 20s to there's some kids like 20 years older than that. And just being around the writers and talking to them, coming from all parts of the country, all parts of the world even. And where I had been, my friends sort of weren't writers and didn't know the language of writing, and so that was the most wonderful experience about being in Iowa.
I'm talking to Dan Pope. His new novel is Housebreaking. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Dan, we're drawing down on our time, but I would like to ask you, before I let you go, if you have any writing advice for our listeners, perhaps on fully fleshing out scenes and not being happy with just simple descriptions that don't squeeze out a little more.
Scene by scene is how a book develops. You keep piling them on top of each other. I would say, depending on what type of writing you're doing, or perhaps in every writing, just if you're writing something that sounds familiar, it has a ring of cliche. If it's something you've read before or seen in a movie, it just maybe don't go that way. That's already been traveled try to make it new, break out in your own direction. That's the first thing I notice when I'm reading student work, is this is a cliche or the character is too familiar. So that's one piece of advice. My main piece of advice overall would be really just to keep at it. The best writers I know, the most successful writers I know are the ones who've really maintained at it and treat it like a job, who work 8 hours a day. And the ones with sort of the great talent who don't have that sort of 8 hour a day or something up to 8 hours, who don't treat it like a job, you sort of don't hear from them again. There's like one or two great short stories and maybe one novel, and that's it. So it's the talent, but also it's that, you know, the real everyday hard work, people who treat it like a job, I've found, who are the most successful in the long run. So don't give up, just keep going would be my general piece of advice to every young writer out there.
Well, Dan, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
That was Dan Pope, author of the new novel Housebreaking. During the second part of the show, John Mutter, co-founder of the website Shelf Awareness, will be here. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with author Dan Pope. Next up, I'll be speaking with John Mutter. John was the longtime executive editor of bookselling at Publishers Weekly and executive editor of the former PW Daily for Booksellers. He is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the popular publishing industry website, shelfawareness.com. And I am pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi there, John.
Hi.
And I understand that Shelf Awareness celebrated its 10th birthday this week.
Yeah, just on Monday. So 10 years ago Monday, we sent out our first issue, and it's quite a momentous occasion for us.
Yes, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Now, Shelf Awareness has a lot of readers. You have 62,000 followers on Twitter and over 390,000 likes on Facebook. And I understand it's popular with book publishers, booksellers, librarians, marketers and publicists, agents, authors and readers. So for those who aren't familiar, can you explain what the site's main purpose is, its mission?
Well, our sort of foundational part is the Shelf Awareness email newsletter that goes out every business day to people in the industry. And we focus that on booksellers and librarians. The idea is, like, we give them the information that they need to do their jobs better. And so that was what we founded 10 years ago. And that has about 33,000 subscribers now. And then about 5 years ago, we started a consumer version called Shelf Awareness for Readers, which comes out twice a week. It's all totally different material. It's geared to general readers. We have about 350,000 subscribers for that. And that consists mainly of book reviews and then interesting articles about writers and the writing process and something we call book candy, which is really popular, funny lists and items. We send that out directly to a lot of readers, but we also do a partnership program with a lot of independent bookstores across the country and a few around the world. And we have over 100 partners now, and they send a co-branded edition of Shelf Awareness for Readers to their email lists, And so that's how we get a lot. That's probably about two-thirds of the 350,000 subscribers that we have. So, and that keeps growing slowly and steadily. And as I say, we even have a few international booksellers who are sending us out, because there's a lot of English language stores, of course, around the world. So those are our two main things. And as I say, we're kind of in the industry. We have this focus on the bookstores and the libraries, but we're read by a lot of other people in the business, all those people that you mentioned earlier, because we have a kind of, sort of a viewpoint that other places don't have. Some of our competition is more geared toward publishing news, sort of like a typical important news story would be a publishing house story or a book being signed, whereas we focus more on what books are coming out now and what authors are on media now. And as I say, book reviews are very important for us. So that's sort of what we are in a nutshell.
Yeah, and given your history with Publishers Weekly, it's clear. Well, I would love to hear how exactly it got started. You said it started with the newsletter strictly to people in the industry. So how did you go from point A to point B?
Right. What we call it our origin story is when I was at PW, as you mentioned, I started up this an email newsletter. This is going to sound a little familiar. An email newsletter that went out every business day, geared to booksellers, and it was one of the first. As far as I know, one of the first business email newsletters, because this was, 1995 or 96 when we all started getting email addresses and we were trying to figure out how we could, take advantage of this. So we started writing information to booksellers and a little bit librarians. And it took off mostly by word of mouth. And after a while, publishers wanted to start advertising in it. So we started advertising, started to make money. And we had a little staff, and it was going along very nicely, but we were owned by a huge worldwide media conglomerate, and they wanted us to charge for subscriptions. And we tried not to, because we knew that booksellers didn't have a lot of spare money to pay for that kind of thing. And we said, if we charged, it would kind of kill the golden goose. And eventually they put everything behind a paywall, and sort of as we figured, the bookseller readership declined, and then the publishers stopped advertising, and then we had this newsletter that wasn't making money anymore. And around that time, the magazine started to shift its focus. It tried to be more consumer-oriented, and so my area, the bookselling retail world, was not considered as very important. And this was also when magazines were hitting on really rough times, so they were firing a lot of people, and I got shown the door. And of course, it was one of those things where one of my friends said, "Someday you're going to look back and say this is the best thing that ever happened to you." And I was not in the mood to hear that at the time. But a year later, I said, "You're right," because I wound up. I knew Jen Risco, my business partner, a friend in the business, and when I was, let go. She called me up and was wanting to know what I wanted to do and what had happened and all that. And I said, well, I had some leads on regular kind of jobs, but what I really wanted to do was do that newsletter again, because it had really resonated with the readership, and I was getting, emails from booksellers saying, "Oh, I wish you could start that up again, and we really miss it." And at the time, PW was feeding, giving up on that whole business. There wasn't anybody doing anything. So Jen and I had this long conversation, and at the end she said, "Well, if you're really serious, I'm really interested." And then, boom, that's how we started. And we, as I say, we started 10 years ago on Monday, and there were just the two of us for the first year or so. And then we had friends who were helping us out. We'd give them wine and pizza if they did a review or a story, that kind of thing. And now we have 12 staff people and about 50 freelancers, and it's really done very nicely, and much better than we had ever even hoped and dreamed at the time. So.
Wow, and 10 years is such a long time in technology terms. Were you able to negotiate to take your email distribution list with you when you left, or did you have to kind of reconstitute that, regrow
that? Oh, yeah, that was, yeah, that we I did not have any access to that. So that we started from scratch. And I think the first issue that we sent out, it was kind of, it was, we had 500 subscribers, and it was all sort of friends and family, although a lot of friends in the business. So, and most of the growth was word of mouth. I mean, we really didn't have the money to do advertising, but we did have, I mean, people knew me and they knew Jen, so that really helped a lot. And we had support from some of the associations in the business who, you know, did stories about us and, you know, told readers how to subscribe and all that. At the time, we were, I mean, obviously, this was before Facebook and Twitter and all that. So, you know, we just focused on email at that time. And we had a very rudimentary website, which has since expanded. But it was, yeah, it was very much just focused on the email. And we were, you know, going to shows and seminars and parties and, you know, handing out cards and all that. It was very much, you know, it was a team effort and kind of old-fashioned media getting it going.
And so going back to your origin story, were you able to preserve that structure nowadays so that there's advertising in the newsletter but no charge for the newsletters for consumers?
Right. And that's, yeah, we've done that with both newsletters. They're free to everybody. And then the money that we make is almost all from advertising. And for the publishers, it's attractive because in the case of the industry newsletter, which we call Shelf Awareness Pro, they can reach a lot of their customers very easily. And these are independent booksellers, corporate booksellers, librarians across the country. And then a lot of kind of and the indies, you know, are kind of tastemakers. A lot of big books that develop because of those people hear about books. So the publishers want them to know about upcoming titles. And then with the consumer newsletter, it's a similar sort of thing. You know, the publishers want to reach readers, and the kind of readers that we have signed up, especially in the case of the bookstore co-branded editions, these are really like, you know, these are serious, committed readers who have gone so far as to, you know, sign up for their local bookstore's email offerings, and, you know, they buy books, and they're, again, they're kind of, you know, they have friends, they recommend books, and so, yeah, it's very attractive to publishers of all stripes, major ones and smaller ones, too.
And so even with your partnership with the independent bookstores, the co-branded newsletters, you just give that to them?
Yeah, we do.
Oh,
we do.
Great.
And for them, I mean, they have the advantages that, you know, especially with smaller stores. I mean, every bookseller I know would love to write a, you know, twice weekly newsletter for their customers, except that, you know, running a small business entails so many things that it's just, you know, they just don't have the time in most cases. So we give them, essentially we're giving them material for free. And then with those newsletters, another thing that's very attractive to them is each review has a that runs in the newsletter has a buy button next to it that goes to the bookstore's page for that book in their website. So, you know, it's really easy for a person at home to buy a book from the store. And then they also have found a lot of people come into the store and they say, they're kind of not aware that Shelf Awareness, often they're not aware that Shelf Awareness is a separate organization. And they'll say, you know, I saw your Shelf Awareness, this book, and I want to, you know, I'd like to get that book. And so a lot of the stores have set up displays in the store of the books that are going to be in Shelf Awareness, you know, in any given week or several week period.
So you've mentioned. Oh, sorry. Please go on.
Yeah, so it's worked out very well all the way around, I think. Mm.
And these book reviews that you've mentioned now, who, first of all, I have several questions about them, but who provides those? Do they come from some of the freelancers that you talked about, or who writes those book reviews?
Well, it's mostly freelancers. We do some staff-written reviews as well. But, yeah, most of them are from freelancers, and we have a lot of reviewers who are booksellers, and then some bloggers, book bloggers, and then other people who are, you know, just, you know, very good readers and good writers. And we do, in the consumer edition, reader's edition, we review about 25 books a week. So we have to be very selective. We don't, you know, obvious blockbuster titles, you know, we probably won't review because they're going to get a lot of play anyway. So we try to find kind of either, you know, mid-list books or titles from smaller presses that maybe won't get as much attention as other places. And we do tend to, we don't write negative reviews because we have such a limited amount of space, and what we're trying to do is present books that we think readers will like to them. So, and you know, if we were doing an exhaustive kind of reviewing, maybe we would do negative reviews. So we'll if we don't like a book, we'll pass on it because we don't want to trash it. You know, we want to use the space for to promote books that we like.
And how do you decide exactly what books are going to be reviewed? Do you have a process, or do you accept pitches, or?
Oh yeah, yeah. Our book review head is named Marilyn Dahl, and she has, I can attest, she has at home and in the office, there are piles of books, galleys that, you know, go up as high as any human. they all look like they're about to. If one goes over, it's going to be like a domino thing. So she gets sent galleys from most of the major publishers and other houses across the country, and then just literally sorts through them and tries to pick out stuff. And then we have among the reviewers, you know, everybody has their general interests. So she sends the titles to the reviewers, and they check them out. And, you know, we're looking for a good fit, you know, somebody, we don't want somebody to be sort of like reluctantly reviewing something. So if somebody doesn't want to, you know, looks at a book and says, I don't think so, I don't like this person, I don't like it, for whatever reason, then they won't have to review that book because, you know, it's going to show event, you know, in the review. So yeah, we're pitched, she's pitched all the time, and it's a laborious but fun process, and so far it's worked out pretty well.
So in terms of authors best taking advantage of your site, do they make sure a galley gets sent in and cross their fingers, or is there more that they can do, and also just staying plugged in terms of what's going on around them, or do you have any?
Well, I mean, we get a lot of queries from publicists and then sometimes from authors about the status of the things that they've sent in. And I know Marilyn's very good about answering those calls. I mean, she can't really promise anything, but and also we do have some opportunities. Maybe if a book isn't going to be reviewed, there might be an opportunity for an author to do something else in the Shelf Awareness for Readers issue that, like, would help the sale of the book and help them get attention. Like, we have author interviews. Sometimes authors write essays. Maybe there's some kind of topical connection with, you know, something that's going on in the news. There's a variety of other things too. And you know, we can't promise anything, but we try. So we encourage. We're happy when people request things or, you know, ask if there's anything they can do.
And if you don't mind saying, John, what's the best book you read in the past month or so? Do you have time for much pleasure reading?
Well, it's actually kind of funny. I do read less than I used to. sort of, you know, just random kind of reading. I usually wind up reading things that are, you know, it's either because I've met the publisher, or I've met the author, or I've heard a lot about a book that's coming out and I want to do something. So to answer your question, I was at the London Book Fair in April, and I met some publishers of a smaller English language house that I'd never heard of before called Bitter Lemon Press, and they were talking to me about this book that's just come out in the U.S. It's called Tin Sky, and it's a mystery set in World War II on the Eastern Front, and it's by the author's name is Ben Pastor, which sounds like sort of an American name, but Ben Pastor is actually an Italian woman, and she had married an American and learned English, and she's probably in her 60s now, and she's been writing mysteries for a long time, and she lives most of the time back in Italy, but she writes in English. She has this mystery series with a German officer who is, as I say, like in this one that I'm reading now, he's on the Eastern Front. And it's really fascinating. I love mysteries. And it's just the story of the author intrigued me. So I grabbed a copy of the book, and I'm about halfway through it, and I really like it. So Tin Sky by Ben Pastor from Bitter Lemon Press. Mm. And I am looking forward to the new Harper Lee book. I'm very curious about that.
But
that comes out in about 2 weeks. Go set a Watchman.
Is that one of those ones, though, that won't get a review on Shelf Awareness because it doesn't need any help?
Right. Well, there's two problems with that one. It has more than enough attention, but also we can't get a copy of it before it comes out. So, we would, if we could see it in advance, maybe we would do something, but just because of the significance of it. But unfortunately not this one.
I'm talking to John Mutter, co-founder and editor-in-chief of the publishing industry website, shelfawareness.com. And we're drawing down on our time, but just for fun, since it's summer, and you mentioned that one of your favorite things in life is to visit bookstores, and you shared with me that you've even been to our own UCI bookstore. if people have an extra, slot in their summer travels, what bookstore should they be sure to hit that is a gem in your eyes?
That's so hard to narrow down, but there's some, like Powell's Books in Portland, Oregon is wonderful. Tattered Cover in Denver. I'll keep to the big cities because I guess more people will go there. New York has a bunch of different great stores like Greenlight and Three Lives and McNally Jackson. Washington, D.C., Politics and Prose is a fantastic bookstore. And the Miami area, Books and Books, has a bunch of different stores, but the flagship store in Coral Gables is amazing as well. So that's way too many, but I could go on and on.
Well, it's a start. And John, thanks so much for being on the show.
Okay, well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
That was John Mutter. He's co-founder and editor-in-chief of the popular publishing industry website, shelfawareness.com. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Barbara is back. One of her guests will be Emily St. John Mandel. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.